Thanks for inviting me into your home. Long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. Bob Guccione Jr. was 9, maybe 10, when his father launched Penthouse Magazine. His parents were divorced. Bob Jr. grew up mostly in London during the swinging 60s. At 17, he edited and published a step-by-step guide to Kung Fu, becoming Britain's youngest ever publisher. At 19, he became the youngest ever U.S. publisher of a national publication with Rock Superstars, a mid-70s magazine for music fans. A little more than a decade later, he founded Spin, the alternative culture magazine that defined the 80s and 90s. He left the magazine in 1997 and founded Gear Magazine, and now he's back at Spin 23 years later as the creative advisor. And he's launched a new online magazine called Wonderlust, about travel and food and the arts. Bob joins me in the first hour to discuss his late father, the time Larry Flint allegedly hired a hitman to have his father killed, Bob's falling out with his dad, and their eventual reconciliation, the famous Spin expose on Live Aid and Bob Geldof, his new role at Spin, and his passion for travel and his new travel site, Wonderlust. Then, in hours 2, 3, and 4, the title of Derek and Sharon Gilbert's new book, Giants, Gods, and Dragons, was inspired by an argument that broke out within the Dungeons & Dragons gaming community. And while Giants, Gods, and Dragons obviously figure prominently in the J.R.R. Tolkien novels that inspired D&D, they're very much more than the stuff of sci-fi fantasy. They're real. They're in the Bible. And they play an important role in the final war of the ages. But coming up next, Bob Guccione Jr. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett. This is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Bob Guccione Jr., welcome to Coast. How are you?
Hey, Richard. Good to be here.
I want to start, if we can, talking a little bit about your dad and Penthouse Magazine. I'm going to assume that when you were 9 or 10, you maybe didn't comprehend the erotic nature of the female human form. But when did you begin to understand the impact of Penthouse Magazine, or that, you know, that it was such a huge deal?
Years later, to be honest, because when you're in the eye of the storm, you don't feel the storm. And so it was just what my dad did, you know, like some people's fathers worked for a bus company. Some people's fathers worked for, you know, the bread company. My dad had a magazine. It didn't register with me until I was about 15 and we came back to America as a family. And, you know, when I went to high school, my classmates were well aware of it. And so that sort of made me see it through their lens and realize, oh, yeah, this is kind of spicy and controversial. But I always joke that when my father started the magazine when I was 9 years old in London, that I was the only 9-year-old boy in the world who was, you know, punished for not reading Penthouse. I didn't want to see it, you know. So it was really very, very nondescript. It was just something that happened. My dad was very smart. He never allowed any of us, my siblings or myself, to be anywhere near the model shoots. You know, we never saw a Penthouse photographic shoot. When we met, which was very rare, but when we met one of the models, when we got older, we were allowed to go to the sort of cocktail parties and meet some of them. They were strictly off limits to us as boys, and ladies were told, don't ever go out with my sons or you'll be fired. So it wasn't until it was about late 20s, early 30s, I worked out how to get around that, you know? So then my father had quite cleverly kept us, you know, away from potential problems. And also, you know, we were taught very, very much from the beginning to be utterly respectful of everybody, but particularly the women around us. You know, people often are surprised to find that my father was a great gentleman, wouldn't allow any bad behavior, fired top executives for, you know, a single instance of being over the top or even just using bad language around women. And he was very mindful that, as you know, his work was provocative and controversial, and he would always be held to a high standard. And he made sure that he and all of us were utterly respectful, always respectful, ultimately respectful. And so, a lot less salacious than people think.
Right, right. How did your father get on with Hugh Hefner? Did they see each other as competitors?
Yeah, they did, of course, and they didn't get on well at all. They actually disliked each other immensely, although they only ever met once, and it was a brief, you know, shaking of hands in passing, so they did not know each other. You know, I met Hefner and spent time with him once when I launched Gear Magazine. I interviewed him for the magazine. He was a fascinating man, brilliant man, really, really enjoyed him. And I thought very similar to my father, very philosophical, very intellectual, collapsed Catholic, you know, somewhat torn between, you know, the morality of the institution and the, you know, adopted morality of their own worlds. So, you know, a fascinating guy. I liked him. And I, at the time, was estranged from my father, which was unfortunately estranged from him for 18 years. When I reconciled with him, I told him about Hefner. I said, you two would actually like each other. That didn't lead to anything, but, you know.
Well, there was certainly no love lost between your father and Larry Flint from Hustler magazine. What?
No, well, Flint was a different case. He was a scum.
Right.
He was a bad person. You know, I think one thing your listeners need to know about Larry Flint was this was a man who hated women. You know, my father adored women. He was a painter before he was a publisher, and he was a deep romantic and, you know, painted classic nudes and painted sort of more abstract Mogliani-ish, Picasso-ish nudes. But he loved women. He loved them in person, and he loved them abstractly. Hefner was the same. Loved women. And both of their magazines adored women. They put them on altars. You know, they worshipped at the altar. You know, the man's greatest objective in life was to find a good one, in the view of my father and Hugh Hefner's publications. But Flint, it was the exact opposite. It was about, he literally had a cover where women were put into a meat grinder. In his mind, that's where women belonged, in meat grinders. They were there purely for the vilification and you know, denigration of men who could never get a real woman in real life. So that was a great difference. And I always had a personal dislike for Flint for that reason. He was, misogynist would have been too nice a word. He literally hated women.
Did he really hire a hitman to take out your father?
Well, apparently he did. I was actually, you know, I heard you say that in the introduction. It's interesting because I was there when the FBI came to tell my father that they'd uncovered this plot. One of, I guess it was their informants or their undercover guy, I don't remember which now, was contacted to put together the contract between Hefner and whoever the hitman would have been. And it never happened because the FBI twigged it. So I guess that spooked everybody. But I was there, and two FBI agents turned up at my father's house. And said, we'd like to talk to you. And, you know, they gestured to me. I was about 18 at the time. And I was just sitting with him. And he said, you know, we'd like to talk to you alone. My father said, no, you can say anything in front of my son. I said, well, okay. And they laid out the whole story. So I have a very, very vivid memory of that. And it was, there were others, apparently. I don't remember who that he had it in for, but my father was the main one. He had a real hatred of him because my father made fun of him publicly. My father was a very adroit and clever man. He'd be on television shows, and he would just put Larry Flint down, and Flint didn't have the intellectual skills to sort of counter that. So he would just stew and you know, vilify him in his magazine, and then sometimes publicly make vilification of my father. And then, of course, apparently this hit thing. We'll never know because nobody's around anymore. period. But that's what the FBI was very sure was going to happen and warned us. And, my father had extra security.
It must have been particularly annoying then to you and your father when Larry Flynt is, was portrayed as this defender of the First Amendment in the Milos Forman film.
Yeah, I watched that movie, of course, and it was, it was a fine movie as entertainment, but it had no bearing on reality. It really fantasized about Flint's, bravery. He had no bravery in that sense. He just simply didn't want his business shut down. And in those days, the only retort the government had against those magazines, this is the Reagan era, very, very conservative, was if they prosecuted for obscenity, because the First Amendment allowed Penthouse and Playboy to publish, and Larry Flynt's magazine, Hustler. But Hustler was clearly an obscene magazine with no redeeming value to it, no real redeeming editorial value. So it wasn't as protected from the obscenity charge. So when Flynt was, what he was fighting for was his existence. And, they very much romanticized it. The man was also, I think, mentally ill at the time. And, those whole things were berserk at the Supreme Court justices and called them, terrible things. So I think that movie greatly romanticized his role. Absolutely.
I want to talk a little bit about Swinging London, because you grew up with your mother in London, England, after your parents divorced. You were young, like 10 years old when,
9 years old,
the Stones and the Kinks and the Beatles and all of this was happening in London. So you couldn't really, I guess, participate in it, but you obviously were aware of what was happening. Just maybe paint me a picture of what it was like growing up in London in that era, coming out of the Second World War and this sort of, cultural rebirth in Great Britain.
It was electrifying, but I couldn't have told you what it was like. I was too young. The music was there. My mother played the records. I didn't particularly care at the time. She obviously couldn't go to the clubs because she had 4 kids to look after. My father was never interested in music and was a workaholic. And so neither one of them participated in that scene. It was their generation that was, living that sort of swinging 60s. But you could feel the electricity. And it's interesting you mentioned the Second World War because, I was actually born 10 years after the war ended. And, the mid-60s, the war was only 20 years away. By contrast, Vietnam War is 50 years away from today. At the time, the Second World War was still a very, real presence in English life, particularly London. You'd walk past whole building sites, whole blocks, several block areas that were still rubble from the bombing. And yet the swinging 60s and the, sort of the introduction of the pill and the sexual liberation and rock and roll, all this crackling electricity, you felt it. It was there. There was a brightness and a life that, even though one didn't understand intellectually or viscerally, you just felt it. So it was a great time. It was a very, very exciting time, even though, my knowledge of it is all retroactive, from years later reading back about it. Like, I was there. I was literally in the park when Rolling Stones played in Hyde Park in London. But I was a soccer fanatic, so I dragged my friend to go kick a ball. And he wanted to go see the Rolling Stones. I don't know, look, we got the pitch to ourselves. We were the only two people in Hyde Park who weren't at the concert. We had all the pitches to ourselves.
Priorities, right? Priorities.
Forgave me. I don't think that guy ever forgave me. So I missed that concert. Hundreds of thousands of people went. And it was David and I on the other side of the park kicking a ball around.
I read an interview where you were describing, again, I guess you and your pals were playing in an area, and there had been some shells, some ammunition from the Second World War.
Yeah.
You guys were
an unexploded bomb.
What happened? Obviously, nothing too serious. You're still here.
Although that's not always the case. What happened with us was we were kids. I was literally about 9, 10 years old, and we were playing on a bomb site. We all did. We played on these sites. There wasn't much else public space-wise. And I found a bomb. Big thing. You know, I mean, the bomb was... Well, I was small, so the bomb would have looked bigger than it was. But it was sort of, you know, the size of a jet ski, roughly, you know? And it was wedged in the rubble. And so I kept jumping up and down on it, trying to loosen it.
Nicely played.
But I was like, I don't know why I was more agile than them or something, but I jumped up and down there. And a policeman came over, a young guy, must have been in his 20s or something, but of course it was a big deal, adult to us, you know. And he just said, come down, lad. Don't think you should be doing that. He gently took my hand and got me off the bomb. And I didn't blow up. You know, there are lots of unexploded bombs in London. Even now, again, they come across one. And, you know, they didn't explode in 1940, they weren't going to explode in 1965. But every once in a while, one does. And there was a sad story recently about, they were doing construction in London and for a building complex. And a, earth mover rolled over one and blew up, killed the guy. So they're serious things, you know. I guess every once in a while you get unlucky. But I think they still find them. Like in the 21st century, they have found some. So amazing that those things are still there.
Right, right. New fatalities from a war that's been over for nearly 80 years. So Spin Magazine, you in the mid-80s, what at that time made you think that readers not needed, because I know you think in terms of want rather than need, but what made you think that they wanted kind of an alternative to Rolling Stone magazine?
Well, the thing that most made me think that was Rolling Stone magazine. It become very boring. And look, I say this, and I want to be clear to all your listeners. I have nothing but supreme respect and admiration for Jan Wenner. And Rolling Stone was the model for Spin. You know, it was for its generation, which was slightly older than me, what Spin was for my generation. And, you know, we used it as the model consciously and unconsciously. And so I've got total respect for it. But during the early 80s, it became very dull, became very corporatized. They realized it was a monopoly. It was the only real magazine in the music field that anybody cared about. And, you know, artists wanted to be there, movie stars wanted to be there. So they just started going more and more mainstream and more commercial. And I was 27, 28 when I started working on Spin as a prototype. And, you know, my generation, my friends and I, we were making cassettes for each other because we'd find new music and you couldn't get it on mainstream radio. You couldn't even see it on MTV. Had just started, but even they weren't doing it. They were still doing pretty much mainstream music. And Rolling Stone never covered it. And so, you know, we were handing each other these cassettes and discovering music. And sometimes some of the more erudite friends would give you a cassette with, you know, Arab music and French music and, you know, all kinds of different ethnicities from around the world, African music, all be very exotic. So there was this, obviously this fantastic world beyond what Rolling Stone covered. And Rolling Stone tended to cover the same stuff over and over, like on a loop, it was a rotation. And so I thought, well, when I was young, Rolling Stone was important to the people a few years older than me. They really cared about it. This is why I started a magazine where people my age group really care about it. And we cover the music that we like. And so that's what we did. We covered... We were alternate by default, you know, because what we were doing, they weren't. But we were totally mainstream for our audience. You know, we were totally dead, bullseye, dead center for our audience. This is what they wanted. And the other thing about Spin, and I say this, you know, when asked, I'm going to consider that you asked. But as you said, when Rolling Stone started, nobody took pop music and rock and roll seriously. So they did. And when we started, everybody took it too seriously, so we didn't. And it was that irreverence that really, you know, characterized Spin. We were intelligent. We were honest with our audience. We told them what we thought. Even when we were wrong, we said, oh, we're wrong about that, but that's what we thought. And we were very sincere. We were enthusiastic. We weren't cynical. These are all the things that Rollins want to become. They become dull and cynical, and you know, we just weren't. So we, I would say, we
Bob, sorry, pardon the interruption, Bob. I hear that music percolating up, so we've got to step away for just a moment. Stay put. We'll come back. Talk more about spin. We'll talk about travel. Bob Guccione Jr. with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. More to come on Coast to Coast. Hey, welcome back. A rather sizable cash prize, $50,000, is up for grabs to anyone who can prove that a legendary Minnesota lake monster dubbed Pepe exists. According to a local media report, the odd reward is the brainchild of Larry Nielsen, who serves as the president of the Tourism Bureau for the community of Lake City, home to Lake Pepin, where the creature is believed by some to exist. Now, as for how one might go about collecting the Pepe bounty, well, it's not quite as simple as merely snapping a photo of something anomalous in the water and then waiting for the check to arrive. The winner of the prize must not only take a picture of the creature, but also somehow procure a piece of the beast, preferably a fin or some skin or, I don't know, maybe a fang. That material would then be handed over to a specialist at the University of Minnesota Biology Department who will determine if the creature in question is an unknown species residing in the lake. You can read more in the highlight carousel up at coasttocoastam.com. More of my conversation with Bob Guccione Jr. when Coast returns in mere moments. Stay with us. Bob Guccione Jr. stays with us, founder, publisher, Spin Magazine, Gear, and his new project is a travel site called WonderlustTravel.com. We'll talk about that in a few moments, but just getting back to Spin, Bob, if you could indulge me a few moments here. And we think of those iconic Spin covers with Madonna and, of course, the Lollapalooza one of Kurt Cobain, I guess, was published after his death, which was like the biggest seller. Any other favorite covers from Spin over the years?
Oh, many, many, many. I mean, you said the Madonna, that was our first cover in March of 1985. And I believe it was her first ever cover. And the photographer, Herb Ritz, it was his first ever cover. So it was kind of a nice moment for everybody and a great way to baptize the magazine. But we did many covers with Kurt Cobain and Nirvana. We did the first ones in January 1991, I think was the first one. The one you're referring to was after he died. That was the biggest seller of the magazine because he was such a hero to our readership. And he was a friend of mine. I was actually very close with him. And we were friends because I never wanted anything from him. I was the only guy in the world around him who wasn't asking for something all the time. And he sort of regarded me as kind of a big brother. He would call me up when he had problems with his wife and ask for advice. And he asked me for advice about going on that last Lollapalooza tour. And I said, don't go. You're the biggest rock star in the world. Nothing's going to change that. You don't need this. If you're that unhappy about it and that against doing it, don't do it. You know, if you're not in control of your life and career at this point, it doesn't get any better. You're the biggest stars in the world. But his management, in the end, kind of pressured him to do it. I think that was part of what, you know, brought him down, frankly. He was a, you know, drug addict person. Naturally, depression comes with that, but he was on top of that depressed. And so I just don't think he was emotionally stable enough. And I think, you know, he wasn't ready for that kind of superstardom. Some people are. And also, most, you know, superstars in rock music took 5 years to get there. You know, the U2 weren't stars for a long time. You know, the Beatles got there pretty quickly, but Nirvana got there in like the slash, was just there. And they weren't emotionally ready. He wasn't emotionally ready for it. The others were. But no, he was a tragic guy. Favorite covers, you know, one of my favorite ever was cover we did, which was the theme of the issue, was the search for the soul of rock and roll. And I think it was the guy from The Replacements was on the cover, actually. I forget his name, Paul something. But the issue was great because I said to my writers, meet me at the airport at 9 a.m. They all came to LaGuardia. And for some, that was just a connecting flight. For some, it was a direct flight. And I said, I'm not telling you where you're going, so dress for hot weather and for cold weather. It'll be one or the other. and that's how you itch. And when they got to the airport, I gave them their tickets, cash, and their instructions and where they were going. And I said, you're going to go search for the soul of rock and roll. I'm not telling you where you're going until the morning of your flight, because I don't want any preconceived notions. Now, this was before Google and before the internet was ubiquitous. I don't think anybody even heard of the internet in this time. But so research meant going to the library. But I didn't want anybody researching where they were going. And I said, just go. Walk around the streets. Go to clubs. Go to bars. Talk to people. You'll know it when you see it, but find it. It was a fantastic issue. Because each writer, who was, they were all great writers, you know, they went and they just went with an open, obviously an open mind, and, you know, open to all experiences. And in their way, each of them found the soul of rock and roll. It was a great, best issue I think we ever did. There were some other great covers. One of my favorites visually was the first Sinead cover, Sinead O'Connor. And I don't know, many, many great covers.
I just have one more spin question, I promise, and then we're going to move on to a new project, Wanderlust Travel. And that has to do with Live Aid and this expose that you did at Spin on Live Aid, the idea that the money that was intended for, you know, Ethiopian famine relief didn't necessarily go to Ethiopian famine relief.
Oh, it absolutely did not. It absolutely did not. It wasn't even like there was leakage. There was a complete diversion. What happened, this is one of the stories I'm most proud of in all the years that I published Spin and before I sold it in 1997. What happened was, I was at a dinner party, my father's house, funny enough, and somebody, they always had Ransom guests, fantastic people at dinner. And somebody there was, I can't remember, a relief aid worker or something for the UN. And Ethiopia was in the news at the time. And Live Aid had happened, you know, 6 months earlier. And he said, people don't realize this. Ethiopia's at war. They have a civil war going. And, you know, everybody just thinks it's a famine. There's actually a whole war going on. So that really stuck with me. The next morning I went in to the office and my sister was interning with us. So I said, we've got a project. We've got a library, so we can find out about Ethiopia and a civil war. Well, in those days, you had to go to the library and look at microfiche. You know, in these sort of viewing machines, you go through, you know, thousands of pages of newspapers. And she found that some of the British papers were, and the Indian paper, funny enough, in English, were reporting on this civil war in Ethiopia. She came back to the office late that night, and her face was ashen. She said, this is unbelievable. She said, the famine is man-made. There's no need for this famine. See, every year Ethiopia has problems. Some years they have bad famines. But even in the bad famine years, they can cope with it. That this is not abnormal to them. But this particular one was created by the Ethiopian government against the secessionist rebels who wanted to form Eritrea and did, of course, in the end, form it. And so they were napalming their fields. They couldn't grow anything. When Geldof raised the money through Live Aid, and then, of course, other relief organizations just piled on, like Red Cross and UNICEF, gave them hundreds of, it wound up to be hundreds of millions of dollars. He channeled that straight to Mengistu, who was the Ethiopian dictator. And he was told, you know, we discovered in our reporting, he was told what was happening was that Mengistu, the dictator, was taking the money to buy more Russian weapons and to, the only people to sell to him. And to basically turn the tide of the civil war in his favor. And he would break up entire villages and towns and tribes of the secessionists and make them march, you know, 100 miles, 200 miles, 300 miles on foot. And of course, these people were dying on the so-called resettlement marches. And 100,000 people died on those marches, which would not have been possible without the infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars of cash. That Geldof brought, but Geldof didn't react when told, by the credible people who were in the field, don't give this guy money. It's not going to help anybody. And of course, we all remember the stories of, you know, tons and tons of relief food rotting on the docks. You know, they had no intention of helping out the people who were being victimized by the famine. Ethiopia is the world's third poorest country then. And it had the largest army in Africa. So, you know, we exposed this, and of course, you know, Geldof was horrified and you know, attacked the publication. But our reporting was solid. We almost went out of business. The record industry didn't want to give us ads. They were so upset by our story. They pulled all their ads. But I did hundreds, maybe 1,000 interviews, including on this show, Coast to Coast. I was on Coast to Coast at least once, or maybe twice during that period. And I would just bring the case to the public. And I'd say to every single person who interviewed me, you're part of a news organization. Look it up yourself. If my sister, who's interning, can break this story, you can break it. And that's what happened. People started looking themselves. And finally, the Wall Street Journal came out with an editorial that said, Spin Magazine's right. This is exactly what happened. And that ended it. You know, then people wouldn't let Geldof control where the cash was going, and the money, you know, dried up. But very late, after a lot of damage had been done. So it was a powerful expose. You know, unfortunately, you just don't get that kind of journalism very much anymore. You know, that's one of the things that, you know, sort of really disappoints me about digital media. For all the fantastic potential of media that can be multi-formed on one platform, we get very little good investigative journalism. It's a really shame.
Right. It seems to be all about, you know, clickbait and unique views. Yeah. And I think, as you pointed out in one of your interviews, a lot of these publications are getting, like, you know, Huffington Post and some of these others were getting like millions and millions of views, but people weren't really, they're just kind of glossing over it, I guess.
Yeah, well, they have no connection. There's no visceral connection to, you know, Huffington Post or BuzzFeed. If they went away tomorrow, 99 out of 100 people wouldn't know it, because 99.9 out of 100 people get that information via a link. And, you know, do you really sort of realize where you're getting your link from? Not really. Would you know if it wasn't BuzzFeed tomorrow and if it was, you know, Richard Feed? It doesn't matter. You just get a link, you read it, you know, sort of volatile entertainment for 30 seconds, a minute and a half, something, and you move on. So those companies, ironically, are struggling because they have no roots in the ground. And, you know, when I got into digital media, Wunderlust is the first purely digital media company I've ever had. It was with the determination of bringing a solid foundation of journalism and reporting and good writing and humor and irreverence about travel and not doing clickbait. So we're behind the curve in terms of audience growth because we're not doing that clickbait. But ahead of me, the big market leaders like Condé Nast Traveler and Travel and Leisure are struggling because all they have really is clickbait and a sort of, you know, kind of, I hate to say, phony reporting, but non-critical. Let me say that, non-critical, because, you know, the people they're reporting on are their advertisers as well. So they're caught in a bind. They can't criticize the advertisers because they have such a fantastic overhead that they have to bring in the revenues. They can't afford to lose any. And as such, they're on this flywheel. You know, they're constantly trying to stay in
right.
motion.
Churning out content, but not really delivering the story.
Exactly. And it's interesting to use the word content because I never use that word. And I say to all my editors at Wunderlust, it's not content, it's editorial. Content is, you know, styrofoam chips in a box. That's content. It's tuna in a can, you know. But editorial is something which is the product of your best efforts, your intellect, your imagination, your morality, your value system. So I want that from my writers. You know, I want their best efforts. And, you know, I believe, you know, a bit in the minority these days, to be honest with you, but I believe the future of digital media is actually the same kind of quality and value systems of print media, which is that, you know, people will want you if they think you're worth their time. And we want to create a loyalty with our readers so that they're around tomorrow, you know. And, you know, it's a different view. It's an old world view of new media. But, you know, we also like the palette, the sort of new media palette you can do so much with.
Right.
So, you know, that's more than you asked.
That's all right. It's all good. Wonderlusttravel.com. Now, I read where someone asked you, you know, what makes for a good travel writer, or who are the best travel writers? And you said crime writers.
Yeah. Crime writers and war reporters, frankly. Because in both cases, the environment, the actual physical landscape and, you know, cityscape, where they are, is a tremendous character in this story. It's a tremendous part of the story. It's not just a backdrop. There's a spirit and an essence and a sensuality to a place that is very, very crucial to a good crime story, and of course is absolutely crucial to good war reporting. I've been in two war zones, reported from Bosnia and I reported from Kosovo, and in both cases, the savage landscape, the devastated landscape of countryside in Kosovo and Sarajevo and Bosnia were elemental to telling the story. So I've always found that the writers who've been to, you know, been war reporters and crime writers give you the best sense of travel of any other writer. A unique view, I must admit.
Right, right.
I don't think so.
We just have a couple minutes here, but let me ask you, when it comes to travel, are you someone, was that a saying from Buddha, it's better to travel well than to arrive? I mean, are you someone who likes to travel luxuriously, or do you like, you know, sometimes being uncomfortable when you travel, maybe even to the point where it hurts a little bit. You know, those sometimes forge the lasting memories. Which do you prefer?
Well, you know, it's an odd question. Because what you're teasing out of me is, am I a masochist? And boringly, I am not, you know. But I have had my greatest life-affirming experiences, funny enough, life-affirming in places where I've been surrounded by death, and that is Kosovo and Sarajevo. And in both of those places, the rawness of the human spirit was so very evident, but so very ephemeral, because quickly people, when they survived the horrible catastrophic situation like a siege of Sarajevo or the devastating, you know, ethnic cleansing of Kosovo, when they survived that, they just want to get on with their lives. They did the hard part. They survived it. They don't want to dwell on it. So I was there in both cases just after the war. I was there when Kosovo, the war was on, Sarajevo, it ended, and I did a piece about them. The kids who had survived, the young people in their 20s, who had survived the siege. And even while I was there, I could see these people beginning to get over it. I was there 8, 9, 10 days. And Kosovo was there about the same time, and it was more raw because it had, literally, I went in with NATO when they liberated the country, so that's how fresh that was. And it was so life-affirming because life is like, you know, spring after the bad winter. I mean, it was, you know, these people suddenly realized they were alive. They had made it through that hell. You know, so that was an experience far greater than eating at the best restaurant in Paris, frankly.
All right. You know, Bob, I wish we had more time. I'll have to get you back on if you're game, and we'll talk some more sometime.
Absolutely. That was a great question. I appreciate it, but I'm not a masochist.
Travel, the travel site is wonderlusttravel.com, wonderlusttravel.com. Bob, thanks so much. When we come back, Derek Gilbert, Giants, Gods, and Dragons. Back with more on Coast to Coast AM.